Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Today on the program, we've got marijuana, capital punishment, polygamy. Wow, this list is so long. Joining me in studio this morning, Tribune Justice reporter Jennifer Dobner is back. Hi, Jennifer.
Good morning.
Also with us, editorial writer George Pyle. George, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Investigative reporter Matt Canham is in the house. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
And joining us by phone, Justice reporter Nate Carlisle. Hi, Nate.
Hi, Jennifer.
And you are welcome to join us, too, with the stories that have occupied your mind this week. There's a lot on the table, so we'd love to hear from you. Put your comments at sltrib.com. You can tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. You can also call us. 801-355-TALK is that number. 801-355-8255. Nate, we'll start with you. Indictments came down against 11 members of the polygamous FLDS Church. Seven are now in custody. Tell us who was arrested and what are the charges that they're facing?
Well, the two most important people arrested are Lyle Jeffs, who's been running the FLDS for his brother for a number of years. His brother, of course, Warren, is in prison in Texas, probably for the rest of his life. And Lyle's been the day-to-day man operating the sect. The next most important person indicted is John Wayman, who has been a long time, second tier in the FLDS. He's owned businesses. He owned the Escalade that Warren Jeffs was captured in 2006. And he actually has a detention hearing today, Friday, that may determine if he's going to sit in jail while he awaits trial.
Now, these two gentlemen appeared in a federal court here in Salt Lake City this week. What did they say? Did they say anything?
They didn't say anything except not guilty, which, of course, is a pretty typical answer for the first hearing. They haven't given any interviews. I'm not aware that the lawyers have said much at this point. It's probably pretty unlikely they're going to have anything to say till trial. These are people who do not give interviews and don't really want anything to do with the public.
Now, what is the federal case? What evidence do prosecutors say substantiates the allegations of food stamp fraud?
Well, we presume they have some eyewitnesses because there was some testimony about this at a civil rights trial in Phoenix that's actually still underway. Basically, what was been alleged this week in the indictments is what was testified to in that civil trial. You also presume that they have some corroboration from the merchant and the government records of the food stamp benefits.
Now, you mentioned the federal case happening in Phoenix. The FLDS Church plays a central role there. Expand on that for people who have not been following. What is that case about?
Well, it's, the Department of Justice is suing the municipal governments in Hilldale, Utah, and in Colorado City, Arizona, arguing that those municipal governments discriminate against people who do not follow the FLDS. And while it's technically the municipal government's on trial, it's really all about the FLDS and whether they exert controls on the municipal governments. And there's been a wide range of testimony to try to prove the federal government case. A man named Dwayne Barlow was, I think, the first witness in the trial, and he had a litany of things to say, including testimony about how the FLDS was misusing food stamp benefits by ordering people to turn in their food stamp benefits to the church, and how some FLDS businesses were getting reimbursement for the food stamps, even though they weren't actually giving food to anybody.
So this case, along with the arrests that happened this week, what's the reaction in the FLDS community and the former FLDS community?
Well, the former FLDS community is ecstatic. I mean, these are people that have been complaining for years about Lyle specifically and the underheadedness in the FLDS. As far as the people who are still loyal to the Jeffs, who knows? They don't talk to reporters either. In past experience, you assume that they just see this as another persecution against their leaders.
One of the arrests, Seth Jeffs, yet another brother of Warren and Lyle, happened up in South Dakota. What is happening up in South Dakota?
Well, as you said, Seth is a full brother to Lyle and Warren, and he's been running the compound in outside of Pringle, South Dakota, and apparently they were also in on the plot to steal food stamp benefits, at least according to the federal government. As far as what's going on in South Dakota, it's still pretty unclear. There were some vague references in the court documents about how only the chosen people are supposed to be up there and how a lot of Warren's wives are in South Dakota, but it's still not completely clear just what that compound's central purpose is, if it has a central purpose.
George Pyle, what does all of this mean for the FLDS community?
Well, I think that this is a situation where they will probably claim, as Nate says, that they're being persecuted by the mean old non-godly federal government, but this doesn't really have anything to do with religion. This has to do with fraud of food stamp benefits. And it could be people who are any religion or no religion could conspire to do this. It does happen in this case that when you have a community where people blindly follow one or more people who claim to actually speak for God, and therefore nobody can stand up and say, now, wait a minute, is this really a good idea? Is this moral? Is this legal? Are we all going to get arrested for this? You have a situation where nobody's allowed to say anything like that. So then you have what we have here is that then the feds have to swoop in. And as we hear, the people who have left that lifestyle, have left that community, are probably saying, finally, somebody's paying attention.
Hmm. Nate, Lyle is in custody. Seth's in custody. Warren Jeff's behind bars. Who's in charge of the FLDS church now? Do we know?
We don't know for sure. We can take some educated assumptions. There's still two full brothers that are free, Nephi Jeff's and Isaac Jeff's. And they're kind of the two closest parts of Warren and Lyle's inner circle that are still out there. Again, they're full brothers, and this is the family that Warren has always relied upon to help him run the sect. It's not clear that they really have anybody else outside their full-blooded siblings that they trust enough at this point to actually take charge of the sect.
It's interesting. I mean, Warren Jeffs was facing some really serious charges, child rape, all that. Here we have food stamp fraud, and yet there are still some, quite a few, loyal adherents to this sect. I mean, is it going to strengthen Loyal's position within the church now that he's been arrested, or will it weaken his power somehow?
That's difficult to say. If you look at Warren Jeffs, on one hand, he did use the criminal charges against him to kind of strengthen his position with the faithful, to say, look at what the government's doing to me, look what they're doing to our leader. But eventually, word of what Warren actually did seeped out, or has seeped out, and it's spurred a lot of people to leave the FLDS. It's a little different with Lyle in that the allegations aren't quite so salacious, but it's still a criminal charge, and he is basically accused of denying people food. So that may not sit well with some of his, for the moment, faithful.
Hmm. And is he going to be asking to be let out on bail, and what are the chances?
He'll certainly be asked to be let out on they call it pretrial release in the federal system. He certainly has a chance. It is a nonviolent offense. Yeah, he's a first-time offender. It's pretty typical of the federal system to let people out on a nonviolent offense pending trial. However, the government is prepared to make a big case about all the resources that Lyle has to flee. I'm sure they'll be bringing up Warren's run from the law 10 years ago as part of that. So I would wager Lyle stays where he is, the Davis County Jail, until trial. But he is going to have a case to be released before them.
All right. Nate Carlisle from the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll let you get back to your reporting. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Jennifer.
And if you want more about the information about the transformation that we are seeing within the FLDS Church, we're holding a special public forum this Wednesday night at 7 here at the Salt Lake City Library. Come on down. It's free. If you can't make it, you can watch it at sltrib.com or listen live on KCPW. Let's move on. For those who were caught in downtown traffic today, Matt Canham, there is a reason. There's a special guest in town today. What's the occasion?
Vice President Joe Biden is here as part of the administration's, quote, moonshot against cancer. And he's speaking at Huntsman Cancer Institute in about an hour here. He's going to do a tour and then sit with a roundtable group of researchers. The administration is putting about $1 billion behind an increased effort to cure cancer. And the vice president is leading up that effort. And then he's going to go from here to California to appear at the Oscars.
Ah, very nice. Got the tux in his suitcase.
That's right.
Biden is known for making off-the-wall comments. Do you think he's going to talk about the presidential campaign while he's here in Utah and his own decision not to run?
You know, I don't know how scripted this event will be. I mean, he'll walk around a cancer research facility. You know, when you talk about something as serious as life and death and cancer research, it might not lend itself to off-the-cuff remarks. But Joe Biden is Joe Biden, so who knows?
What are you expecting to hear, George?
Well, I imagine mostly it will be, you know, to say good things about the Huntsman Cancer Institute, which is what a lot of people do when they come to Salt Lake City for anything remotely related to this. But yeah, you got to watch Uncle Joe every minute. He might say something really interesting. He might tell us that actually they've already cured cancer and they've kept it a secret. And he might also know, he might also have the line that a lot of people have said, you know, if President Obama does cure cancer, the Republicans will come out against it.
The one thing I'd say about Joe Biden is he is the emotional force behind the Obama administration. President Barack Obama is a pretty cool customer. And other than, I would say, the mass shootings in which he's spoken and gotten emotional about, he does tend to be very staid. Joe Biden wears his emotion on his sleeve and always has. And cancer is a very personal thing for so many people in this country. And he is a pretty good spokesperson for talking about that kind of pain.
Okay, we will track what he says during his short stop over in Salt Lake City. Let's move on to presidential politics. And Matt, this week you announced... You reported that Republican officials announced that Utah will have a place in the raucous arena of GOP presidential debates. What are the details?
This was a shocker. The Republican Party set up 9 debates in this electoral season, assuming that they would need only 9 debates to determine who their nominee is. And then it became kind of clear that that's not going to work out for them. So they looked for where to put the next one. And on March 22nd, there's going to be a presidential debate in Salt Lake City.
21st, I believe.
Oh, excuse me, 21st. 22nd is the presidential caucus. So it's they're holding their debate the day before our presidential caucus to try to drum up attention. And local political leaders are hoping that the debate will increase turnout for that caucus vote.
Well, who's going to be left in the field by March 21st? We have Super Tuesday coming just next week.
So I've asked political people here as well as in Washington and in the party, and they assume there'll be 3 candidates. And while they probably don't want to be on record naming them, those 3 candidates would be Donald Trump, Senator Ted Cruz, and Senator Marco Rubio. The other 2 candidates in the race right now are Ben Carson and Ohio Governor John Kasich. With the upcoming Super Tuesday, there's a chance that one or both of those people will drop out if they don't do well, and every poll says they're not going to do well. So I would assume there'll be just 3.
But Kasich's already talking about Michigan and going to Michigan, so he at least publicly seems committed to the long haul.
That is the standard in politics. Mm-hmm. You make it seem like you're going the long haul, and then at some point you get in a room with advisors and say, we ran out of money and we can do math and this isn't going to work out. He could stay in. And that's why I think this is a very odd presidential cycle.
Truly.
And so trying to determine what's going to happen based off of what has happened in past presidential elections has failed miserably pretty much every step of the way.
Comment from Beer Savant at sltrib.com. Tickets hard to score I'm going. So how do people get tickets? This is going to be the hottest ticket in town.
That's a very optimistic individual. They haven't identified the venue, and they haven't identified what TV network is going to host the debate. And then they got to decide what kind of debate they're going to have. Is it going to be in front of a massive audience? Is it going to be in the round and where they're at a town hall type format? When you determine the type of debate, then you get to determine how many seats. I looked at all the debates that have happened this year, and pretty much at the high end is 5,000 seats. Now, in a Republican state like Utah, if you held this thing at a 100,000-seat stadium, I think you could fill it. There is a ton of interest from people who are involved in politics. But there's only 5,000 seats. And of those 5,000, the individual candidates get a selection of those tickets. Every member of the RNC, there is 168 members of the RNC. They each get a ticket and a guest gets a ticket. Then the state party gets a cache of tickets, and they're still trying to figure out how they're even going to distribute these things. They have a sign up on their website at utah.gop where you can give them your information, and they'll tell you how they're going to distribute the tickets. But they haven't even figured that out yet.
Lots of details left to be determined by March 21st. George Pyle, how is this debate going to affect voter turnout the next day here in Utah?
I'm sure that's part of the reason for having it, is to try and increase the turnout, get people to pay more attention to it. Utah doesn't have a lot of delegates. It's not a swing state in terms of Democrat-Republican, so it is kind of a surprise that the party would choose to have this debate here. But as people have said, a lot of people didn't think Donald Trump had a prayer of coming anywhere near, lasting this long, much less being the front runner this deep into the race. And you hear reports here and there that the mainstream, the professional Republican Party is just aghast at the prospect of Donald Trump being their nominee. But of course, they can't say that out loud because he's the front runner right now, and you can't say that. So, is there some hope that Utah might knock him off, that he might come here, do poorly in a debate, which doesn't seem possible because nobody seems to care what he says, and how he could do poorly in a situation where all you have to do is just talk and not have any moral scruples about what you say and everybody applauds. I mean, that's his shtick. So he could do that here as well as anywhere else. The reports we hear is that the establishment is still trying to find a way to knock him off without having their fingerprints on it.
Matt, Utah, of course, is a Republican stronghold. Is this debate a reward for that loyalty, something that Utah Republicans have earned, or is there value in Utah delegates? Like, the vote is split up,
right?
And so every delegate vote counts.
Every delegate vote counts. Utah has 40 delegates. You need about, and I'm going to get this number slightly wrong, but I'm close. It's 1,280-something delegates to get the nomination. 40 is not an insignificant number, and it will be winner-take-all at this stage. So the race in Utah is an open one. The last poll we saw from UtahPolicy.com had Marco Rubio at 24%, Ted Cruz at 22%, and Donald Trump at 18%. So that's totally winnable by any of those people. Part of the reason it's here is because of the calendar. You did your 9 debates. Now you got to look at where the next events are going to be held, the next caucuses or primaries, and the next ones are in Utah or Arizona. They also wanted to have it in the West. So really, it was Salt Lake or Phoenix, and we beat Phoenix.
Mm. Jennifer Doudna?
Well, I was just wondering about the delegate count after Super Tuesday. If Trump comes out ahead, I mean, are we really pushing towards a contested convention?
So in Super Tuesday, all of those states are proportional. So you get delegates based off of your percentage in each of those 13 states.
So he'll still be ahead, though, presumably.
He will presumably still be ahead. I don't think there's any way he won't be ahead. But once you get past that, you can get huge chunks of delegates in places like Florida, California, where it can completely swing the election. So he will be the front runner. He has the clearest path to getting the nomination. But there are plenty of ways this can fall apart.
Who would have thunk that little old Utah would have a role in this crazy election season? It should be fun.
You would have thought it would have happened like when Mitt Romney was running.
Indeed. Yeah. Indeed. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW Salt Lake City, throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. We are headed to a break, but stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce here in studio with Jennifer Doebner, George Pyle, and Matt Canham of the Salt Lake Tribune. And if you want to join our conversation about the week's news, you can tweet to the hashtag TribTalk, comment online, sltrib.com, or you can call us, 801-355-TALK is that number. Let's turn to Utah's Capitol Hill, and things are really starting to heat up at this point in the session. We only have limited time to spin through some of the action. So let's start with capital punishment. One state senator is leading the charge to abolish the practice, the death penalty here in Utah, and the idea was debated in committee this week. Jennifer Doebner, what happened?
Well, it passed. Perhaps somewhat surprisingly, perhaps in part because people think you need to have this is a public policy debate that's worth having in public and on the floor of the full Senate. So it's Senator Steve Urquhart, a Republican from St. George. He thinks that the state should not be in the business of killing people, even if they are guilty of the most heinous crimes. He has been a past supporter of capital punishment and last year voted to reinstate the firing squad as an option for execution in Utah. But he's come around to the thinking that it's just not the right thing to do. Government's infallible. There is documented evidence that many people have been found innocent from death row. There are increasing problems with execution methods, and he just thinks we should opt out. So it's Senate Bill 189. It's on the board in the Senate. It's about 50 down, so probably we won't get to it today, but I think you could expect to hear a floor debate early next week.
Who's opposed to the measure? I mean, I guess in general, Utahns are.
Well, yeah, some recent polling done by for the Salt Lake Tribune, you know, found that about 70% of Utahns still support the death penalty. But I will say that there's other polling out there that when you start to talk to people about the problems, about restorative justice, about the expense of capital punishment, I mean, if you look at Utah, there are 9 guys on death row. 3 of them have been there since the mid-1980s. They are not even close to execution at this point. We spend about $1.6 million per inmate on death row, more over what we spend with someone who has a life without the possibility of parole conviction. And so when you start to inform people about those types of things, the polling really seems to shift. And I understand that there's some local activists who have been doing that kind of polling in Utah, and they're seeing similar numbers. We expect to hear a little more about that next week. In committee, the opposition came from a couple of Republican senators who said, look, we think that this is the appropriate punishment for certain kinds of crimes, and we don't want to diminish the loss of that person's life, nor do we want to diminish the right of a victim to say, I want this person put to death for what they did to my, you know, beloved family member. So I expect we'll hear more of that when it comes to a floor debate.
George Pyle, the committee vote, a little bit of a surprise. I mean, do you think that people are more open to this idea of abolishing the death penalty?
Well, I think so. I mean, some of the polls now, instead of saying, if they say, are you for capital punishment or against, a lot of people will say for. If you word it, would you prefer capital punishment or life in prison without parole, if they're given that choice, then a lot of people would say, well, let's do the life in prison without parole. It's cheaper. There's less chance of making a mistake. If you later found out you convicted the wrong person, you can still let them out. Plus, and we've editorialized about this, the death penalty is kind of a weird thing in American politics. Usually it's the liberals who trust government to do things and the conservatives who don't. In the case of capital punishment, it's the liberals who don't trust the government to get it right. I mean, they're worried about the racial aspect of it, the fact that poor black people are more likely to get sentenced to death than rich white people. And the conservatives, strangely, you know, they don't trust the government to educate your children, build a road, or inspect a restaurant, but deciding who lives and dies, sure, that's fine. Well, I think what Senator Urquhart has decided is that the true conservative position on the death penalty is you shouldn't trust the government to make the right call on something like this. Now, it's not in Utah where you have fewer cases. We don't have a, you know, 150 people on death row. You know, 50 of them are probably innocent because their lawyer fell asleep during the trial. That's Texas. That's not Utah. We don't have that problem. We don't have a feeling that we've executed an innocent person or we're about to, because we just don't do it very often. So we don't have that angle. But still, just in principle, the idea that the government is capable of deciding who lives and who dies in general is not a very conservative outlook. And I think increasingly conservatives, the Nebraska legislature just threw out the death penalty recently. Now, it's going to be on a referendum and they may put it back. But for just that reason, if you don't trust government to spend your money, take your money, educate your children, decide all these other things, why trust it to kill people?
I think that's part of Urquhart's argument. He said it to me. He said it during committee the other day. I did want to talk about one really interesting person who testified, and that was David Shapiro. He and his twin brother are defense attorneys in town. They have worked on capital cases. Their parents were brutally murdered and killed and then left in an arson fire in their home in Arizona 4 years ago. I know both of them, and I didn't know about this, but he testified saying he's not in favor of the death penalty. He knows a lot about the system. He has worked on these cases, and he does not feel like waiting 30 years for the person who killed his parents, who is now in prison but not even close to trial after 4 years, would honor his parents' memory. So I think that really took some people aback. I didn't think anybody was expecting that, maybe not even Urquhart, because it was really a surprise.
Hmm. I imagine we'll hear some spirited debate when it goes to the full Senate. When is that expected, Jennifer?
Well, it's 50th on the board, so I'm guessing maybe by Monday or Tuesday we'll get a chance to hear that debate.
Okay, early next week. Stay tuned to sltrib.com for all the updates on that. Let's move on to another issue that you covered this week, a bill that would ensure that LGBT couples are treated the same as other couples applying for adoption. That bill failed to gain some traction. Can you describe the committee hearing for Senate Bill 234?
Yeah, it was the second time that Representative Angela Romero, a Democrat from Salt Lake City, had brought her bill forward. The first hearing was a couple Friday nights ago. It was quite a contentious sort of discussion, and was a little bit more of the same. The bill is it does not propose new law. It's an amendment to existing laws that basically, in the wake of the U.S. Supreme Court decision that legalized marriage for everyone in the country, just seeks to make some technical changes to make sure that LGBT couples, married LGBT couples, have equal treatment under the law.
So they do now, or they don't?
I mean, they do now, and the Utah courts are already doing these adoptions for families. There were a lot of families. Utah has one of the highest rates of gay couples raising children in the country. Many, many of those people have sought to formalize their relationships with their children through second parent adoptions. Mm. That's what they have to do, or have had to do. Those adoptions were not legal in the past. Now that marriage is legal, by default, all those associated rights of marriage should go to married gay couples. The legislature, or at least the senators in this committee, primarily Representative LeVar Christensen, who was the author of Utah's constitutional amendment to bar same-sex unions, four others on the committee said, we don't read the Obergefell decision from the U.S. Supreme Court that way. We think the decision only compels the state to issue the marriage license, but not to compel any other rights. What they called was an expansion or extension of marriage rights to gay couples. So the bill failed on a tie vote of 5-5. Two Republicans on the committee, Green and I'm going to fail to remember. I apologize. Both said they agreed with sort of the prevailing wisdom, but they again felt this was an issue that deserved a debate in public as a matter of policy. But we're not going to get it this year.
Okay. Another bill that went down in flames. A change to how sex is taught in Utah public schools It would have expanded what public school teachers can teach about sex. It failed in committee. This was House Minority Leader Brian King's bill. And George, you've got some strong feelings about this one.
Yeah, I mean, it's Representative King put forward a bill that would move the Utah public schools from what they call an abstinence-based curriculum for sex education, and he would have the schools develop a real sex education program that really teaches sex education. It would be opt-in, so parents would have to specifically sign a piece of paper that says, yes, my child can get sex education worthy of the name in a public school. For the same reasons the public school teaches them trigonometry and other things that parents can't or don't want to teach their children. It failed with people coming out and saying, oh my gosh, if you teach teenagers about sex, all of a sudden they will want to go do it. Now, obviously, these are people who were never teenagers, because this stuff is hardwired at the factory, and I don't understand how they think that this encourages sexual behavior. I mean, Utah isn't as bad as some American states, although all of America is much worse than Europe, in terms of teenage pregnancy, venereal diseases, things like that are a result of people not being taught the truth about sexual behavior and human sexuality. At the same time, on the other side of the Capitol, the Senate passed a resolution. It is just a resolution. It doesn't ban or create or spend any money, declaring pornography a public health hazard. Okay, now, on one side of the Capitol, the over-sexualization of society is bad, and we need to worry about it. On the other side of the Capitol, but we can't do anything about it. We can't actually teach people the truth about human sexuality, even though we're in this culture that is just immersed in sexual messages and trying to force sexual images on young girls and problems with body image and all the other things that we deal with. It's kind of like, you know, Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, where they took away the defense from the dark arts class on the grounds that there weren't any dark arts. It's not the way it works.
Salt Lake Tribune editorial writer George Pyle there. We're going to take a break from the legislature to go to some questions and comments. This from Joy from North Logan. She called in but couldn't stay on the line. Can anyone explain how the Electoral College is affected by the popular vote? She wants an explanation of that connection. Matt Canham, our election expert.
Maybe. So when you do the popular vote, this is in the general election. It has nothing to do with the primaries. That you get electors by state, and then the electors are the ones in the Electoral College who actually do it. So what this is the popular vote is by state, not by nation. Is pretty much the key here. That, and the best example in modern times is George W. Bush and Al Gore, that Al Gore got more votes nationwide, but George W. Bush won more states. And so that's the difference between how the Electoral College works.
All right, Joy, I hope that answers your question. This probably a better question for Nate, who is not on the phone anymore, but maybe George as an opinion. Peter Gessel on Twitter, any guesses of the odds that Lyle Jeffs and others will be held without bail per the prosecutor's request? Oh, maybe Jennifer can jump in here.
There's no bail in the federal system.
Okay.
So that sort of is off the table. Three of the defendants have already been released on their own recognizance in St. George, but they have ankle monitors. So, I mean, I suppose there's a chance of that. Not with Lyle.
Yeah.
I think Nate said, I mean, one of the things that the prosecution will argue and the judge will have to weigh, and at state level, federal level, anywhere, what is the chance that this person will show up for trial or run away? And given the history of the Jeffs family, I think the prosecutors would have a good case that if we let them out, ankle monitor or no, they're going to run away. So we better hold them.
Okay. Again, if you want to chime in, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. You can tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. Let's go to more action on Utah's Capitol Hill. Lawmakers authorized an audit of the University of Utah's athletic department. And this caused quite a stir because of the timing. And Matt Canham, you are a University of Utah super fan. I'm just wondering, are you in favor of the audit of the athletic department?
So it's interesting. You got to kind of separate a couple things out. One is the motivation behind the audit and then the audit itself. As a journalist, I'm in favor of audits of government. I want them to audit everything and give us the audits to determine where government is performing its function and where it is falling short. The interesting part of this is what's driving the audit. And the elected officials, including House Speaker Greg Hughes, said that a significant factor was that the University of Utah won't play BYU in a basketball game. That they're so upset about a basketball game that they're going to spend the rest of the year and three auditors' time to dig through the athletic department's records. There is no focus of the audit. The audit essentially is just look at their stuff and bother them, and hopefully you find something that we can get them on.
And we know they make a lot of money.
Yeah. I mean, so there is a lot of money in the athletic program. I do think the athletic programs at the public colleges are worthy of looking at. These are government institutions. This one's weird just because of the motivation.
Mm-hmm. And you can't audit BYU because they're a private school.
Right.
So.
And it does make it seem like you're playing a little bit of a collegiate favorite. And in this state, with those two universities, it seems like it could be on just a college issue and a private issue that goes into religion and everything else.
And the roots of this sort of, we're not going to play BYU, is the basketball game from, was it last season?
Well,
it was in December,
yeah.
That there was a fight.
You know, and honestly, as a fan of the University of Utah, I do think they should play the game. I don't understand why you wouldn't play the game. There's a lot of interest in those things, and it just strikes me as the university took its ball and went home, and I don't ever support that kind of activity. You can just say that punching someone in the face is not part of the game, since it's not, and the likelihood of that happening again seems kind of low.
George, do you accept that this was sort of a random audit, or does the timing look suspicious to you?
Well, the timing is clearly suspicious, and the legislature, you know, doesn't really have many ways that they can express their, I suppose they could pass a resolution. There are states where they've passed laws. I think it's in Kentucky. They make, by state law, the University of Kentucky play Louisville. Sometimes a university doesn't necessarily want to play another really good university because they get a loss, and then that hurts their chances come tournament time. In the case of Utah, in addition to the fight, there's always the thing, well, now they're in the Pac-12, a major conference, and have a lot of TV revenue, a lot of TV time. Do they want to spend their time possibly losing to a school that, however popular and big it is in Utah, is in a minor conference and isn't going to do well for their record, for their RPI or whatever, getting up to the tournament. But as we say, you know, a government audit of a government agency that spends a lot of money, some of it from who knows where. I mean, when Utah joined the Pac-12, they joined major college athletics where there's a lot of money. Some of it may be under the table. Some of it may be influencing the way the whole university works. Universities like popular and successful sports teams because it gets some exposure on TV, and they hope that means more people will want to be students there, more people will want to teach there. But if you get into the situation where the tail is wagging the dog, and it's, as the president of the University of Oklahoma once said, I'd like to have a university to make my football team proud, are you in a situation where athletics is taking over? Now that, if there's any suspicion of that, and at this level there probably should be suspicion of that, is a legitimate cause to go in there with your auditors.
Before we leave Capitol Hill politics, there are so many issues that came down this week. Can't leave without mentioning medical marijuana. Utah Senate yesterday passed Senator Mark Madsen's bill that was in some dispute. It now goes to the House. And George, what do you think? Is this the year that medical marijuana is legalized in Utah?
Well, it still has to go through the House, where I don't I'm not sure what its prospects are, but you know, they may have exhausted themselves just getting it through the Senate. The governor has been kind of wishy-washy on it. I would doubt that he would veto it if it passed the House, but you never know. And they had to water it down a little bit to get it through the Senate. I don't know if they would have to make still more changes to get it through the House, but they certainly had some emotional testimony and committee and debate on the floor about how we ought to just get with this and stop trying to take away something that really seems to help a lot of people live decent lives.
Well, I do think it's interesting that it passed, in part because of the sort of input from the LDS Church that we had on this bill.
Two statements.
And it's generally seen on the Hill when the church speaks, then everybody falls into line. But this time that didn't happen. And the hate crimes bill is up this afternoon for a floor debate, in which has been lumped into that, you know, another statement from the church saying don't do anything. So it'll be interesting to see if people vote their conscience and not their, ecclesiastical sort of direction.
My theory, the threat of an initiative. That's just my theory. I wish we had time to talk into it. Full legislative coverage. We're tracking a ton of bills. Check it out at sltrib.com. I want to move on to the Supreme Court of the United States, because that has dominated national headlines. And here in Utah, Utah senators say President Obama should not appoint the next justice to replace U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, who recently died. Matt Canham, you've been following this story. What's the justification?
He's a Democrat.
All right.
They're Republicans. That's the real justification. As someone who's covered politics for a while and has followed a few Supreme Court nominations, both Democrats and Republicans, try to infuse this with facts and precedent, and really it comes down to partisanship. Mm-hmm. This is the end of a presidency. They're hoping that a Republican wins the White House and therefore that have someone who thinks more like they do on the bench. Justice Antonin Scalia's death is incredibly significant in the fact that the ideological breakdown on the court is 5-4 conservative. With his death, if a Democrat replaces Antonin Scalia with someone who's more liberal, the ideological shift changes, and it could change for decades. And that is a huge, you know, significant impact on our history of this country. The decisions that can be made could be very broad. And so this is going to be a fight no matter what.
Senator Mike Lee says, no, absolutely not. We're not going to even have a hearing for whoever's nominated. And Senator Hatch had a personal appeal from the president this week.
Right.
Was he swayed?
Not at all.
Now,
Orrin Hatch has been on the Judiciary Committee for decades. He's a former chairman. And he has a history of voting for nominees who are not from his ideological viewpoint when there is no other justification not to vote for them other than that they're liberal. He's voted for Ruth Bader Ginsburg as an example. He doesn't block Sotomayor or Elena Kagan, the two nominees that Obama put on the court. So he should be a gettable vote, and he has been one of the most hardline because of his seniority, saying that it's the end of a presidency. Let's just wait till next year. It's not that big a deal if the court spends a year at 8 justices instead of 9.
There's a lot of speculation out there, though, that if the president appoints a Republican or someone who has recently gotten through a judicial appointment, how could they possibly refuse? George, do you think that will hold any sway with Hatch and Lee?
Probably not. I mean, it's the election year. It's the election year of Donald Trump and Ted Cruz. And the idea, I mean, there's no shame right now in the Republicans just doing what they've done for almost 8 years, which is blocking everything Barack Obama puts up because Barack Obama put it up and for no other reason. You know, the joke earlier about how if he cured cancer, the Republicans would be against it. So the speculation, and this is supposedly informed speculation, the president might nominate somebody who just got approved 98-0 to an appeals court. The president might nominate the Republican governor of Nevada who's pretty conservative. The president might
who said he doesn't want it.
Who said he doesn't want it. I can understand. Well, there are a lot of people who would love to be on the Supreme Court but don't want to go through what
right.
the process to get on the Supreme Court would
yes.
be. He might try and send out an olive branch and say, look, this is an eminently reasonable, totally qualified person to sit on the Supreme Court. The only reason you could be against it is because it comes from me. And actually, I mean, they're talking about the election, and I love the crack about how they must think the black president only gets 3/5 of a term because all of a sudden he's no longer empowered to appoint justices. Now, people on both sides who say this is the way it's done are reaching because the Constitution is very vague on this. It says the president shall nominate and advise and consent. It doesn't even say how many justices are on the Supreme Court. That's all by statute. So they can do anything they want.
We could spend an hour on this. We've got to scoot to another break. Unfortunately, you're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW Salt Lake City throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Time for our final segment, the underplayed story of the week, the story that's going to continue to occupy our thoughts and public policy. Jennifer Dobner, what's your pick?
A story out of Salt Lake City. Jackie Biskupski, the mayor, has launched a Design Your Transit System survey for residents. It's a 4-week deal, and I think it'll be interesting to see how many people participate and how they actually vote, given that this time of year there's a lot of complaint about the quality of our air. It'd be interesting to see if people actually move toward public transit.
Mm. Okay, take the survey if you live in Salt Lake City. I'm sure they want to hear your results. George Pyle, what's your pick?
Well, with the legislature so busy, everything's a little underplayed. But the thing I thought was interesting was the Senate committee approved a resolution changing Columbus Day, second Monday in October, to Indigenous Peoples Day, marking an idea that maybe the person who introduced genocide and disease to the New World is not necessarily somebody who ought to have a holiday named after him.
Or
now,
the state that's named after
or a state that's named after a Native
tribe.
American tribe. Now, in New York, where you have all those Italians and Columbus Day is still like a state holiday where people don't go to school, that'll never fly. But here, it's interesting that it would even get this far.
Mm-hmm. As a former resident of Berkeley, yes, I have lived under the Indigenous Peoples Day regime, and it's great. Okay, Matt Canham.
Real quickly, I would also do a legislative bill there. When they moved the prison from Draper, they voted to move the prison from Draper to Salt Lake City, they put in there a tax. The Salt Lake City can increase the sales tax by 0.5 cent to recoup the cost it takes to have all that state land you can't tax. Well, the legislature is now trying to remove that ability, that because Mayor Jackie Biskupski says she's not immediately going to use it, then the legislature, it wants to take that tool out of Salt Lake City's toolbox, and the city's not happy about it.
You don't want it? We'll take it back. Matt Canham, Jennifer Dobner, George Pyle of the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks everybody for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to wrap up this week with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. This week he talks labels.
If you say you are from somewhere or you go to such and such a church or that sort of thing, people will automatically make assumptions about you, and which is okay, I suppose, except that it allows them to kind of stereotype you, that you'll be like all the others they've heard about or know about.
You wrote a great column back in 2010 about an encounter that you had on tracks and how someone lumped you into a group just on a few factors that it wasn't right.
It was a guy from out of state, first time in Utah, and I was asking me questions about Utah and wanted to know if I was Mormon, and I told him yeah. And from that, he concluded that I would be a Glenn Beck fan, which I am definitely not. And so he got, I guess he got his stereotype a little rattled there to find out that not all Mormons think alike.
And later in the column, you talk about how this grouping happens pretty early.
Yeah, it happens pretty early, and it happens fairly consistently throughout your life, and which is one of the reasons why people like to hang around with their own kind, because there's no misunderstanding or no judgment in there. And in this column, I got labeled by teachers in school who concluded that I was simple or lazy just because I didn't follow along. They may have been right about my performance, but it was also less threatening than considering the possibility that it was because they were deleted boring. Later, when I temporarily became a genius, I did it to other people as well. I assumed that everyone could be assigned a seat in my life based on knowing almost nothing about them. Today, I never assume that all blacks are good at sports, that Jews are automatically good with money, that being Irish is synonymous with being drunk, or that I have nothing to physically fear from women. While these may be nationally accepted stereotypes by idiots, and even the basis for the material in some humor routines, personal experience has taught me that it's dangerous to behave as if they were fact. Worse, it's boring.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby, and you can find all the Kirby archives online at sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines, a production of KCPW, UPR, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Tom Williams and Bennett Purser at UPR, Emily Means from the Tribune. Two quick notes, a public forum, Trib Talk Live, Polygamy in Short Creek. It'll give you all the information you need to know about what's going on with the FLDS Church. That's Wednesday, March 2nd at the City Library. Listen live on KCPW or come on down at 7 o'clock. Also, Utah Public Radio, it's on its second to last day of fundraising. Contribute 800-826-1495.